This afternoon, the Women's World Cup final between the USA and the Netherlands will be viewed across the world by a global audience of millions, part of the remarkable journey that women's football has come on this summer. Here in Ireland, it's been a slightly slower march to prominence and one which hasn't been without its fair share of controversy. So where did the women's game come from? What sort of direction is it going in on this island? Well, Donal Fallon, football anorak as he is here to tell us. I mean that in the complimentary way. I hope you understand that. Donal, thank you for coming in as ever. Came here long after it arrived on the island next door.
It did. Before getting into soccer, I mean, it's worth saying women's sport in Ireland, generally speaking, isn't a very healthy place. And you know, the best attended final anywhere in Europe last year, one of the best attended finals in the world, was the women's Gaelic football final. But the story of women's soccer in Ireland, as you rightly mentioned there, it's been a pretty slow story, you know, and it is one not without controversy. Football, the beautiful game, association football, arrives in Ireland very late in the day by comparison to the neighbouring island and Europe in general. And amazingly, it's one man. You know, it all falls down to the hard work of one man, John McCallery, who was a Belfast drapery merchant. He is the head honcho of the Irish Tweed House in Royal Avenue, Belfast. And this man has the great idea to invite two Scottish football teams to play an exhibition match in Belfast in 1878. And for most people in Ireland, that is the first they hear of this game, association football. And, you know, a big crowd come to see it. The sports journalists in Ireland didn't really think an awful lot about it.
Oh.
One of them said, the players went around butting at the ball like a pack of young goats, which still sounds like Irish League football in Belfast these days.
Well, it remind you of one of those playground games where there's no formation. You just have like a swarm of 8-year-olds chasing
the
ball.
Yeah, absolutely. But I mean, the game in general here, one, it's far behind the neighbouring island. And I mean, the big issue, of course, is that there's a cultural revival happening in Ireland in the late 19th century. So you have Michael Cusack, you know, founder of the GAA, rallying against what he calls the foreign faction, the Orange Catholics and the West Britons, who kick a football up in the Phoenix Park. But for some women, I suppose, sport and politics went hand in hand. I mean, An Cumann Camogiochta was founded in 1905, and Paul Rouse, the great sports historian, says that the early camogie players were pioneers who flew in the face of public opinion. Many hit their hurls under their coats as they travelled to play in order to deflect ridicule from the wider populace.
I love that turn of phrase you ascribe to Michael Cusick there, Orange Catholics. That's one that we could spend a lot of time unpacking afterwards, especially with the week that's in it. On topic though, it was quite late in the day as well before there was a documented women's football match in England as well.
And I would say, look, women are playing football as long as men are, you know, as long as the game has existed in any form. And I always make the point, football is the most egalitarian sport in the world, really. Four jumpers and a ball and away you go. And it doesn't matter if you live in Rio de Janeiro or the west of Ireland, you know, if you've got four jumpers and a ball, away you go. But the first actual recorded game of association football between two female sides in England only happens in 1895, which is remarkably recently. I mean, Bohemians, Shamrock Rovers, all these clubs are established in Ireland. The game has rooted itself here before there's even a women's game played in England.
Yeah, it's quite striking. Now, there were some factors driving women's sports, and obviously a desire for a certain amount of emancipation and greater independence is chief among those.
Yeah, and the early pioneers of the women's game in Britain, I think they're brilliant characters. I mean, they're double jobbing, so to speak. You've got Helen Matthews, who's a Scottish suffragette, so she's campaigning for the right of women to vote, and she's also quite passionate about the right of women to kick a football. And then the brilliantly named pseudonym Nettie Honeyball, who's the founder of the that's what they know her as. And actually, Nettie Honeyball is this great mysterious character. We don't know an awful lot about her, but she founds the British Ladies Football Club. And the main problem that they have when they set up the BLFC is there's no one to play against.
Yes.
So
you might find
11 women that are willing to play football, but you need to find 22. And it took them a while to realise that. So, I mean, the search for belonging in the football pitch for women at that time, it's wrapped up in the much bigger picture of kind of women's individual freedom. And the bicycle had arrived on the scene and women were travelling a lot more. But Irish and British women are different, you know. And one camogie player in 1911 in her diary says, "We want something to supplement the ballroom and the skating rink. We want to organise the womanhood of Ireland into one grand body whose sole object under that of national emancipation would be the raising of our sex from the slough of a false and foreign civilization." So in England, women are playing football in some cases because they're being politicised through the suffrage movement. In Ireland, it's wrapped up in all of this
it's
cultural nationalism.
Very much an expression of identity as well. That we're coming up to World War I though, and that's a big turning point in terms of the women's game.
Culturally, World War I changes a lot of things in Britain because the men are gone. You know, hundreds of thousands, millions of men are in the trenches of Europe. And the game kind of continues in their absence. And you get these brilliant
teams.
So
it's like a kind of a League of Our Own situation where suddenly the men are all off the pitch and then the women just have to keep the sport going.
Absolutely. And women will take their place. And the public houses open up to women as well, of course, because you got to sell beers and the only people left are women. So you know, the role of women in British society in the early 20th century is changing an awful lot. And there's a great team, the Dick Kerr's Ladies FC in Preston, who are a brilliant, brilliant team. I mean, Dick Kerr is a locomotive manufacturer that's kind of rushed into wartime service as a munitions factory. And the women there are just brilliantly good at playing football. I mean, they beat one Scottish women's select 22-0 in 1920. That sounds like a cricket score.
It does.
You know, not a football score. And they became internationally renowned. They played in front of massive crowds and they played in Belfast January 1921 in front of an Irish selection. But the Football Association weren't particularly happy to see teams like the Dick Kerr's doing well.
Okay. This is now the English FA that we're talking about.
The English FA, especially post-World War I. I mean, the English FA come out and say, council feels impelled to express the strong opinion that the game of football is quite unsuitable for females and should not be encouraged. Oh. But the likes of the Dick Kerr's ladies team, I mean, they've developed this great love of the game and they just keep going. And I love their manager proclaims, my team will continue to play if the organisers of charity matches will provide grounds or even if we have to play on ploughed fields. You know, we will play anywhere.
That's a real dedication of loyalty to the code that they've chosen to spend their, well, presumably not their Sundays in Belfast, but their weekends playing at the very least anyway.
Absolutely.
Decades later, and for some reasons which are partly hard to explain, we have the second wave of women's football then in the 1970s.
Yeah, and just briefly to finish up on the Dick Kerr's, if anyone ever goes to the National Football Museum in Manchester, which is an incredible museum, they give the Dick Kerr's their place in the history of the game. Now, it's a little bit difficult to explain why this happens, but the 1970s, there's this explosion of women's football.
And there's no obvious trigger for it.
There isn't. I mean, one theory that's often put forward is that the 1966 World Cup, which was hosted in England, you know, brought football into the lives of millions of people in Britain.
You've
and
got
women.
Mass television at the time as well.
Yeah, women watching this went, I quite like to look at that myself. And Dermot Farrador has a great line about the 1970s. He says, it was Ireland's 1960s. You know, a lot of the social change that had happened elsewhere happened here in the 70s. Yeah. And there was a women's movement. And that's kind of reflected in Finglas. You had a wonderfully named local team called Suffragettes FC, which is brilliant. I wonder if they played in purple jerseys. Yeah. Ballyfermot, my mother played for the Ballyfermot All-Stars. But like in wartime Britain, there was something that was happening again where a lot of the teams that were playing in the 70s in women's football were workplace teams. So the Vards team were not from just around the corner from where we are. Julian Vards Furriers on Harcourt Street, they had their own team. Right. And some of the women that emerged here were world-class players. Anne O'Brien from Inchicore would go on to play at the top level in France and play for Lazio. And when she died a few years ago, the Irish Times described her brilliantly as the best Irish sportswoman you never knew, which is just, that sums up her amazing career on the global stage. But why the 1970s? Mm. Why the re-emergence of women's football at that time? That's something that's still debated.
And even by the 1970s and it being Ireland's 1960s, as you say, that's a turn of phrase I'll never forget. And it being an era of empowerment, there was still this perception, though, that this was not a sport for women.
Yeah, there was. And FIFA in the 70s are trying to get a sense of the feeling on the ground when it comes to women's football, and they do this great questionnaire. They write to the footballing authorities in 135 countries and they ask them, you know, what are you doing for the women's game? How do you see the women's game going? One nation replies, may God have mercy on us. Well, Paraguay.
Substantive discussion of the issues there.
Exactly. Tell us how you really feel, you know. Paraguay repeat this kind of claim in their rule book that football is, quote, against the natural femininity of women. So FIFA would have taken very little confidence, you know, from these responses. Mm. And FIFA themselves said the answers show that women's football has still got a long way to go before being more widely accepted as a sport suitable for and practiced by women.
And that was only as recently as the 1970s. And now here we are in the early part of the following century, barely 50 years on, and it's on free-to-air television and everyone's talking about it and people are genuinely looking forward to it.
And there was little ladylike about some of it, in particular the behaviour
of the Cameroon,
Oscar Wilde once said, football is a game for rough girls, not suitable for delicate boys. The Cameroon team may have proven that to be true. But just the level of interest in the current tournament is absolutely extraordinary. And I think if you look at how the game has done in America in particular, I think there's something very profound there. And you know, moving forward in this country, what we have to do is get the infrastructure down, you know, improve. It's not about honouring one brilliant goal. And you know, Stephanie Roach's goal that award-nominated goal.
Yes, for the Puskás Award, yeah.
It was absolutely brilliant. Mm. But what's more important than that is building up a sustainable kind of environment, you know? And some people would argue, listening to this, Irish footballing authorities, there's a lot of other issues on the,
there
on
are,
the table.
There are. There's an AGM coming up in 2 weeks' time we might be talking about at the time.
There's a lot to fix in the FAI at the moment. But, you know, perhaps in the future we will live to see an Irish team face off against the likes of the US on the world stage.
Well, on that topic, I remember seeing it throughout the qualification process, which led up to the World Cup that's on concluding today. Norway and the Netherlands, both teams that are participating in the finals, were both in Ireland's group. The Netherlands, who are now World Cup finalists, came second in a group in which Ireland came third.
Yep.
And the Ireland team got an away 0-0 draw against the Netherlands. They got an away draw against the team who are now in the World Cup final.
Which is
incredible. That isn't a sign of just how close they are to really making some sort of a breakthrough. Then maybe it's time to just to get behind them all.
Yeah, and the crowds in Talis Stadium at those games were fantastic. And, you know, people sometimes say, oh, when Dublin make it to the All-Ireland Women's Final, it's a bandwagon, everyone goes along. So what if it's a bandwagon? It's still a good thing. You know, people engaging with women's sport and sport in general is always a good thing.
Yeah.
And going forward, that's the challenge.
And if they develop any empathy or any sort of moral support for it at all, then it's obviously to be welcomed. Donal, as ever, thank you very much for popping in. Donal Fallon is a historian and he is the author of the Come Here To Me blog and books, volumes 1 and 2 of which are available in all good bookshops now.